Have you heard of the Plot Manuscript? It's 330 pages, an overview of the entire Bible. People who have read it have said it's helped them understand and enjoy the Word of God. Hi, this is Bob Enyar. I wrote the plot years ago. We sell it at a money-back guarantee, $49.95 plus shipping and handling. And if you don't feel that you really understand the Bible now, we want to give you your money back. So go online to order it at kgov.com or call us at 800-8-ENYAR. That's 1-800-836-9278. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. My name is Bob Enyar.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
It is October 1st, 2010. You and I are going to talk about the current edition of the Creation Magazine, the fall edition. It's just tremendous.
Oh, another great magazine.
It's so
another
good.
Another great edition.
If you're an atheist, fasten your seatbelt. But first, Fred, tomorrow night is the Colorado Right to Life Banquet, Saturday, October 2nd. I am so excited about it. Are you going to be there?
I am going to be there, and
right.
It is awesome. I've gone to the last, I think, four, and highly recommend it. You should really make an effort to go.
They're always wonderful,
oh,
aren't they?
It's amazing.
And yeah, so for information, just go to Colorado Right to Life's website. It's at the Renaissance off of I-70 in the Stapleton area. It's going to be great. I can't wait. I'm going to give an overview, an update for the year. What's happened in the last year.
And what's that website, Bob?
ColoradoRightToLife.org.
.org. Okay, great.
All right, so Fred, we've got the Creation Magazine from Australia, Creation Ministries International. And one of the articles that really stood out to me is this article about radioactive dating. They say that the Earth is billions of years old, and they know that because they use these scientific methods to find out how old rocks are, Fred. And they say they're millions and millions or billions of years old.
But don't they sometimes conflict?
Don't they sometimes? Yeah.
Sometimes, maybe
like in
almost every time.
Well, here in this article, they've got some fossil wood from England, and they dated it first using the carbon-14 method. And this is so fun, Fred. Carbon-14 said that it's somewhere around 25,000 years old, this wood, fossilized wood from England. Well, then they find out that the limestone that the wood is in, it's buried in a quarry, is supposedly 183 million years old. And I got out a calculator and I figured out that 183 million years is a lot more than 25,000 years.
Yeah, so if you subtract that, you get 182.999 million
years. So they're off. So anyway, that's an example, right, of two radioactive dating methods that give completely different results.
That's right. And the next one they have is diamonds from South Africa and Botswana. And lo and behold, they used carbon-14, and the dates were 55,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they dated the rocks that they were found in, and they were between 1 and 3 billion years old.
Billion with a B?
With a B. So if you subtract billions. 3 billion from 55,000, you get 3 billion.
Oh, that's right. Wait. Whoa, something's wrong here. And so with carbon-14, its half-life is so short that after just tens of thousands of years, it should all be gone.
It should have all decayed into nitrogen.
It doesn't last millions of years.
So it's a huge problem for evolutionists to even find carbon-14 in diamonds that are supposed to be, you know, millions to billions of years old.
Yeah, and they find it everywhere it shouldn't be. You have radiocarbon, carbon-14, and that is such a friend of the young Earth creationist.
It really is. Yeah. Carbon-14 is a great testimony to the right. Earth can't be that old.
Right.
Because you shouldn't find carbon-14 in diamonds. You shouldn't find it in natural gas, mm-hmm. coal. Yet they find it in these things all the time.
In amber.
That's right.
Everything that's millions or billions of years old. And then, well, look at that. Right in the middle of a rock-hard diamond, there's carbon-14.
Well, you know, the next one here is really neat, too, because they're rocks from Mount St. Helens. So we know the ages of these rocks.
Oh, Mount St. Helens, that blew not too long ago, right?
Yeah, about 1980.
1980.
Somewhere, yeah, I think.
Somewhere
early
there,
in the early
give
80s.
Or take a few hours.
Yeah.
In 1980. And when they radioactive date rocks, they're not saying when the atoms came into existence. That's not their point. Their point is they could determine when the rock solidified, when it hardened. That's the claim. And so we know when the lava flow from Mount St. Helens, we know that that had to be at least since 1980. The oldest it could be is 30 years old.
Yeah. So lo and behold, rock samples were giving ages of, for example, here, 350,000 years old.
350,000?
350,000. And then they dated another mineral called pyroxene, and it came in at 1.7 to 2.8. Million years.
Million years. 2 million years old, and we know.
So it's either 350,000 or 2 million, Bob. Which one's correct?
30.
Well, I know, because I did some math. What's the year 2010 minus 1980?
2010 minus 80, 2.8 million.
Yeah.
I mean, these rocks are 30 years old. Fred, this is true in Hawaii. Lava flows in 1901 or 1801 and, you know, recent lava flows, and they say, this is a million years old. It's like, no, it's not a million years old. There were natives there watching Haleakala blow its top.
Yeah, so the point is, if we can't date rocks where we know the age, if all those dates are inaccurate, why are we expected to trust dates for rocks where we don't know the age?
What a great point. Well, there is a well-known textbook author, Guntner Faur, F-A-U-R-E, Guntner Faur, and he gives examples of radioactive dating where the results are totally different, Fred. Like in Uganda, there's volcanic lava, and the lava is known by the atheist geologist to be relatively young, like they think archaeologists could date it based on archaeology. It's just young, like in thousands of years. And so they dated this with a radioactive method called rubidium strontium, and it said it was 770 million years old.
770
million.
Million.
So 770 million years minus a few thousand years is 770 million years. These errors are on the order of 100% wrong.
One of the points he makes in this article is time and time again, they invent stories to try to explain away these anomalies.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so storytelling. And you ask them, well, how do you know if you're right then? You do different methods, and they're so diverse, the answers. And they say, well, it's the way we interpret it. Well, you interpret it based on old Earth evolution. Well, of course, because that's true. Well, how do you know it's true? Well, the radioactive dating proves that they're old.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of a high school textbook I have, you know, a public school textbook, which says a lot. There's a place in there where it says certain bed of rocks is 350,000 years old, and that's an absolute date. And then the very next sentence says, plus or minus 350,000 years old.
No, come on. That's pretty funny.
That is in a high school textbook.
That
this absolute date is 350,000 years, plus or minus 350,000 years.
Plus or minus the whole conclusion, which is what we're pointing out. Okay, so Fred, we have a list on our website, kgov.com, under Real Science Friday, of a list of not so old things. I'm going to put that fossilized wood in there because that limestone is not so old.
It's not. And we've already got, I think, the Mount St. Helens rocks on there, right?
I think so. But if not, we'll put those on there.
That's right.
All right. So, hey, Fred, you remember a couple of years ago we did a story about the cod fisheries off the coast of Canada where the cod are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So back in the 1990s, the Canadian government said, okay, no more cod fishing here. We're going to give it time to recoup, to grow back. And they never did grow back because they're still tiny, because natural selection is not a creative force. It's a conservative force. It conserves. So if you go in and cull out all the big fish, you're going to lose the genes for big fish, and you're going to end up with small fish. And the genome, the genetic information, is not going to increase. It's going to decrease.
Yeah. Didn't they blame this on global warming?
Well, they've done that since.
Okay.
Fish are getting bigger because of global warming and smaller because of global warming.
Oh, both. Okay. Both.
But so do you remember we did that story?
I do remember a couple that years ago? Distinctly.
The cod fisheries.
And what the UN was involved in that somehow.
Well,
they?
Evolutionists. They, in fact, going back to the time of Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, they asked him, what do we do about overfishing the ocean? And he said, oh, no, natural selection will take care of that. The stronger, smarter fish will escape the nets. It turns out just the luckiest fish escape the nets. And the big fish are disappearing.
You know, evolution is, we know it's not scientific, but it's funny, but almost in a sad way. But yeah, it's just another example.
Yeah.
You know, so this brings up the article in the magazine about bighorn sheep. So we're familiar with them, right?
Bighorn sheep.
Isn't that the state's national or state animal?
State
or something?
Animal?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but could be.
So anyways, bighorn sheep, their horns are getting smaller.
Whoa.
Not only that, their body weight's getting smaller, but, you know, the horns are getting smaller. And
that's sad because hunters spend a lot of money, go up to Alberta, Canada. They go and they look and they want to bring home a trophy.
Yeah, a trophy, big ram trophy, and they're not, they're just not as big anymore. And according to the scientists, you know, the secular scientists,
mm-hmm.
It's an evolutionary response to this hunting.
Evolution? No, it's not. It's because they're killing all the big ones.
Exactly.
And so they're losing the genetic information for bigger sheep.
That's right.
We got smaller ones.
Again, it's a conservation mechanism where, if anything, as you stated, we're losing genetic information.
It's de-evolution.
It's de-evolution.
The sheep haven't evolved new genetic information to evade the hunters. The hunters have wiped out the gene pool for the big horns, and that is sad. And so if these evolutionists would be a little bit smarter, they'd realize selection is not a creative force, it's a conservative force, and if you are wiping out all the big fish and the big sheep, you're going to end up with only little sheep and little fish.
Well, it's ironic, these same scientists that say that it's an undesirable evolutionary consequence, mm-hmm. they then go on to say it will be extremely difficult to reverse this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, extremely difficult. Why? If evolution were true, then you got millions of beneficial mutations every year to account for the millions of species we got in the world. So what's with that?
Yeah. So Bob, if you go to my website, evolutionfairytale.com, there's a picture of an elk. See, this is how evolution should work. He grew horns in the shape of a bullseye.
Yeah.
So the redneck hunters would shoot the bullseye on the horns and not hurt the elk.
Now that's
the way to
happen.
Evolve.
That really should happen.
That's right.
They should evolve targets that are superficial and won't hit any vital organs.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. All right. So, Fred, can we keep going just through this magazine, Creation Magazine?
Oh, absolutely.
I like the article about moths.
Oh, that was real interesting.
Because it talks about the eyes of a moth. Have you ever noticed? We were camping with the Boy Scouts out in the woods. We heard a scream like you couldn't imagine. And we went out with our flashlights. All the dads went out. We're up in the mountains. And you could see from 100 feet away the eyes of an animal reflecting our flashlight light back to us in the brush.
Oh, okay.
Well, a moth, if you turn on your porch light, the moth eyes do not reflect. They stay as dark as could be.
Yeah, never occurred to me.
No, me neither.
So I wonder what value that would have for, you know, say engineers to reverse engineer that and apply that to everyday
use.
Yeah,
because the moth's eye, it's glassy, like eyes tend to be, and you'd think they would reflect light. But if they did, the predators would see them more easily, like in the moonlight. So God gave these little delicate moths anti-reflective eye surfaces. So engineers have figured out, well, if we copy that mechanism, it could benefit us. So what are they making with those, Fred?
So maybe solar panels?
Solar panels.
And so why would that be an advantage?
Well, if solar panels have a glassy surface like they do, and they reflect about 30% of the light back up into the atmosphere. And if you reflect light, you can't turn it into electricity. It needs to absorb the light to turn it into electricity. So they're making solar panels now with the surface modeled after moth eyes.
Wow.
That is so cool.
But the important thing is, Bob, is we need to know what was that animal in the woods.
Fred, I think it was a bobcat. It screamed. It screamed like a woman that was being attacked. It was the weirdest thing.
You sure it wasn't a house cat, Bob?
Not a house cat, Bob. It was a bobcat, Fred. All right. So what else do we have? That's the moth eyes. And, oh, how about, speaking of eyes, how about Richard Dawkins? What is he famous for saying? What is one of the more stupid things atheist evolutionist Richard Dawkins has said over and over?
And, man, I've heard this, a lot. It's about how the eye is wired backwards, so that's a bad design.
The human eye. I mean, it's brilliant how we can see. Human eyesight is just extraordinary.
It's an incredible piece of engineering, yet it's wired backwards, so it's messed up and it's wrong and it's a bad design.
Richard Dawkins had the nerve, the egotism, the audacity to criticize our creator God and say, well, if there is a God who created the eye, he didn't know what he was doing because he wired it backward. Well, Fred, that claim has been debunked for years, but now the evidence is overwhelming so that Dawkins is simply demolished. Anatomists have said, leading ophthalmology anatomists have said that anyone who thinks the human eye is wired backwards simply has a lack of knowledge, education about how the eye functions. It turns out, Fred, that the advantage in the eye being wired, what an engineer at first would say is backward, is so brilliant. The wiring of the eye improves the sharpness of images, gets rid of noise, like light that shines inside your eyeball and then bounces around.
And it filters out that noise.
It filters out the noise. Mm-hmm. Do you know when you look at, let's say you look at a street sign, you're driving along. Well, you see the edges of the sign in a different way than you see the body of the sign. Your vision system separates out the edges of letters, the shapes of faces, from the interior of the shapes. It's just so extraordinary. And Fred, it goes on and on. You know what else the wiring does? It filters out non-visible wavelengths. You know, we only see a certain range of color, so to speak. Well, it filters out the stuff we can't see, like infrared, ultraviolet, and that protects the sensitive cells so they're not damaged, whereas frontward wiring wouldn't do that. And Fred, it goes on and on with their learning about how brilliantly the eye, the human eye, is designed.
And it doesn't even get to your trochlea example.
Oh, yeah, the trochlea.
And that is so cool.
Isn't that great? And we've got that on kgov.com. Just click on Real Science Friday. You'll see our P.Z. Myers trochlea challenge.
So this badly designed eye is held in place by a sling through a little hole, a slit, and somehow we have to expect that evolved through that hole.
Right,
you have to see the picture. It's amazing.
You got to see the picture, how the muscle would, the superior oblique muscle, Fred, would somehow detach itself and go through this little sling and turn from a band to a narrow cord, back to a band. I mean, it's all so fun.
It is.
And P.Z. Myers so far has not answered the challenge.
Not yet, huh?
No, he hasn't.
Shock.
And awe. All right. So, Fred, how about the researchers in Sweden who are, what are they trying to do? They're up to something in Sweden.
Well, it looks like they're trying to invent artificial intelligence. You know, maybe a computer that can think and have emotions.
Can think for itself.
Wouldn't that be like Data on Star Trek?
Star Trek, Data.
So they're trying to create, artificial intelligence.
Yeah. They'd like to do that.
And, so they estimated how big of a computer they would need.
How big of a computer?
The size of the Pentagon.
The size of the Pentagon? You mean to get military intelligence? Fred, our brain fits in our heads, and some of us have big heads, and others have really little tiny heads.
You've talked about that before, right?
Yeah, like the Broncos, front four football players versus, say, a 5'3" woman from somewhere in Asia, Japan, who's in their senior physics class and blows away the football player who has a big head, and she's got a relatively little head, and she's so brilliant.
Yeah. So size doesn't matter?
Not with a human mind. Size does not matter. And yet they'd say, if we could do this, we would need a computer the size of the Pentagon, which, remember, Pentagon, five sides, it's a mile in circumference.
A mile in circumference.
A mile.
Wow.
And so imagine a brain, a computer that big. And Fred, what's fun about this is I studied artificial intelligence in college at ASU, Arizona State University. I took a course. I did well. I wrote a program to play chess.
Oh, cool.
That was way back in the 1980s, early 80s.
Could you beat your program?
Sadly, yes.
Okay.
I could beat my program. But, Fred, I can't beat Big Blue, though. That's IBM's chess playing program.
Okay.
But, Fred, they have no idea what sentience is. Consciousness? They don't know what consciousness is. I mean, how do you describe it in an algorithm, and how do you program it into a computer? It's so bizarre for them to think, well, we might be 10 or 20 years away from making a computer that's self-aware. That is, they can't even come up with an algorithm to describe how you'd go about it. Like, let's say sending people to Mars. Well, we can't do it, but we could describe an algorithm of how you'd do it.
They watch too many repeats of the Terminator movies.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, Brad. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. Okay, what else do we have in here?
We have this article about Craig Venter creating life, and I don't think we've ever talked about this.
I don't think so. What did he supposedly do? The media? What did the media say?
The media said that he created life from non-life. Isn't that what they said?
They did. In fact, they also said God exists, and his name is Ventner. Craig Ventner. Now, it turns out, Fred, that this would be, I mean, what Craig Ventner did is amazing, but it'd be like taking a branch of a pear tree and grafting it into an apple tree, and it grows, and then that branch produces pears, and the rest of the tree produces apples, and saying, I invented life.
Yeah. It might create pear apples. Pear apples?
Pear apples? Well, don't you think the branch would, create... Well, okay, so Fred, that wouldn't be creating life. That would be doing something pretty amazing. And that's what people do. Farmers, they do things like that.
Rearrange things. I like what the cartoon said here, and I think it's worth reading this. If I can just synthesize life here, then I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form life in the beginning.
And you see this wildly complex laboratory.
Exactly.
And so what he did was he took machinery from a living cell, and then he took DNA from somewhere else, and then he mixed up a lot of his own, you know, artificial DNA amino acid sequence, and then he put it in, and it's alive. Well, that's amazing that he did that. It might be dangerous someday, when we tinker with genetics at that level. But it's amazing, but he didn't create life. And the atheists are so desperate that they misrepresent science every day of the week because they're desperate to get people to reject our creator.
That's right, and they do so willfully.
Yeah. Okay, so Fred, how about this article on life being complex, being so much more complex than they dreamed of? This is based on an article from the journal Nature from this year, 2010. And Fred, the DNA, the sequence of the amino acids in our DNA genetics, it's blowing the scientists' minds.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, the article mentions how they thought at one time that there were 100,000 genes, and now they realize there's about 21,000 genes that do all this vast programming, all this tight, complex programming where a set of genes, they're discovering, can program different items from the same set of genes, not just a one gene, one function relationship.
Right.
It's a one gene, multifunction relationship. Try to do that with a software program. Believe me, that's my industry. That would be mind-boggling.
Yeah, you're an engineer, software engineer, and it is mind-boggling. And so it's so hard for them, you know how they like to study genes. So let's find a gene that shows how tall you are or what color your eyes will be and all. Well, it's so hard because one gene has a dozen dramatically different functions. And they're having a hard time comprehending the interaction of the genes and then the operating systems, the multi-layered operating systems in which the genes function. And what they used to think was junk is now very sophisticated regulatory processes.
Well, I love what Dr. Kevin Anderson brought up at one of our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meetings.
Yeah.
And if you read one side of the DNA, we always knew that that was a program sequence, and it would select a gene or a protein, the coding for that protein. What's amazing is that they've discovered that you can go backwards on the other side of the DNA, and you can read it, and it does an entirely different protein. Try to write that in a program where your code.
Is it binary? Is it C++? What kind of code?
Well, our code is mostly C++. But imagine the computer going along reading these opcodes in one direction to run a program.
So the compiler goes through beginning to end.
Yeah, to maybe print out a message or do something. Yeah. And then you read it the other way, and it produces your GPS algorithm. Try that, engineers out there in radio land.
Yeah. God
good luck.
God is just so extraordinary. God is brilliant. What a show that was, too. We had Kevin Anderson in studio. Did a fun show on the human genome.
Well, I love the ending quote of this article you just brought up. One scientist said, "The more we know, the more we realize there is to know." Boy, doesn't that contradict what Eugenie Scott said in her debate with you?
Oh, yeah. 10 years ago, Eugenie Scott, leading anti-creationist, I kept asking her, "What's your best evidence for evolution?" And she said, "Junk DNA."
Yep.
Junk DNA. Eugenie, don't you think we're only beginning to learn what we need to know about DNA to make that conclusion? She said, "Oh, no, we know all we need to know about DNA." And I gave her the chance to take it back. I said, "Eugenie, I'm writing down the date and the time. You should take that back."
I highly recommend that you get that video. It's on your website, right? KGov.com.
Yeah, Bob Debates, an evolutionary scientist.
Yep.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So Eugenie Scott's best evidence against the creator God, just give it 10 years and it's been debunked. Okay, so what have we got now? How about mammal hair and amber? We know what amber is, right? Tree sap?
Yeah.
That fossilizes, and they usually find bugs in it.
And it's billions of years old.
Millions.
Oh, millions? Is it just millions here?
Yeah. Millions and millions. Millions of years old. Now they found a piece of amber from France with hair in it, mammal hair. And Fred, they said, this is a shocking discovery because the hair is remarkably similar to modern mammal hair.
Remarkably similar? Do you think maybe they're the same?
Yeah, they mean that. That's what they mean all the time when they say, you know, these lemurs are so similar. So that's a lot of fun. So much for 100 million year old mammal hair evolution, that it's been identical.
And what we see that all the time in the fossil record. It's called stasis, where things don't change.
Right.
If anything, things get smaller, right? We've got bit examples of huge crocodiles, huge dragonflies.
Right. So, Fred, we are out of time. I want to encourage people to come tomorrow night to the Colorado Right to Life Banquet. We're going to have a great time. You'll be there.
I'll be there. It'll be
awesome. I'll be there. Be there or be square. It'll be the place to be before the election. And it starts at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, $75 a plate at the Renaissance off of I-70. And then, Fred, Rocky
That's near Stapleton, the old Stapleton.
That's
right. Right across from Stapleton.
And Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship, their website is youngearth.org. So check out those meetings. We love those meetings. You're on the board. And Bob and Yurt Live, our telethon, we're up to 71 people who've pledged $20 a month. Please help.